Now shall we turn again this evening to chapter 14 of the book of Genesis and beginning to read once again in verse 8. The book of Genesis in chapter 14, beginning to read in verse 8. The verses that we're going to look at especially this evening is verse 17 and then especially from verse 21 to the end of the chapter. Genesis chapter 14, verses 21 to 24, but beginning to read in verse 8. And there went out the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings with five. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountains. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their victuals, and went their way. And they took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that had escaped and told Abraham the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Enar, and these were confederate with Abraham. And when Abraham heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them on to Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them on to Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the woman also, and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him, at the valley of Sheva, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all. And the king of Sodom said unto Abraham, Give me the persons, and take the goods to thyself. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. Save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Enar, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. Amen. Last week we looked at the first half of this chapter 14 of the book of Genesis, and at that time of warfare that Abraham found himself engaged in, when those four kings from the east came and attacked the city of Sodom, where Abraham's nephew Lot was then living. As we said, the role that we then see Abraham taking on is a role that he has never yet taken on in all the chapters of the book of Genesis that we have read so far concerning him. And indeed, it's a role that we'll never see him in again throughout the rest of the verses and the chapters of the book that speak about him. It's the role of a military man, you remember, the role of a soldier, because Abraham here goes forth to make war against these four kings that have come up from the east under the leadership of King Chedorlaomer. And in that whole total picture, we find the man Abraham taking a complete departure from everything else that we've been told about him up to this point. However, as we said, in the whole total picture that Abraham is meant to present with us in the Word of God with regards to our lessons, with regards to our life of faith here before, it's nothing that's out of keeping with what has been told about that life of faith that we're to live. And indeed, the whole of Abraham's life is just for that purpose. The justified shall live by faith, you remember. And up to this point, we have seen Abraham especially living that pilgrim life, being called out of Ur of the Chaldees into the land of Canaan, walking about that land, finding, as Paul says, no abiding city there, for he looks for that city whose builder and maker is God. He counts himself a stranger and a pilgrim in the land. And in so doing, he becomes a living embodiment for us of the truth that God says in the prophet and in the apostle, that the justified shall live by faith. Now, that's the main underlying thesis, if you like, of the life of Abraham. That's the overall statement that the chapters in the book of Genesis concerning Abraham are really speaking about. Therefore, it's a whole total picture, as we might expect. And so, in a way, there's nothing more apt with regards to our life of faith than that soldierly aspect of it, that warfare that we're called to enter in. And when Abraham here takes up the stance of a soldier and goes forth into the midst of the battle in the way that he does, even there he's setting forth lessons for us with regards to our life of faith. And those lessons, I trust, we saw to some extent in the verses for last week. They're spiritual, of course. The wars and the warfare of the Old Testament all pass in to that spiritual warfare. The weapons of our warfare, says Paul to the church, are not carnal. We enter into an entirely different kind of war as we enter into an entirely different kind of pilgrimage. We're not called to wander in Canaan and live in tents. Neither are we called to fight physical battles in this warfare that God has called us to enter. But out of the physical come all the illustrations for the spiritual. And so we saw the general lesson surrounding the battle when those four kings came up, or down as the case might be, to Sodom, to put down that uprising that had taken place with the king of Sodom and with the other kings of the cities of the plain. Then the particular lesson from the negative point of view with regards to Lot, that man who became the victim of that war, you remember, on account of where his carnal choice had set him, living in that city of Sodom. And then the positive lesson, where that man Abraham prepares, fights the battle, and does it against such great odds, you remember, and with such meager resources at his disposal, 318 trained servants against the power of the East. So was the battle, so was the spiritual battle that we are called into from day to day. Well then, this evening, we begin to look at the sequence of events following on from the battle in which Abraham has just engaged himself. And of course, what follows in the chapter are two encounters. First of all, the encounter with that majestic and that mysterious figure Melchizedek, which we'll look at next week in the will of the Lord. And also the encounter with the king of Sodom. We made mention of him as we came to a close last week. And it's Abraham's encounter with the king of Sodom that I want us to look at this evening. Melchizedek, of course, that's the first encounter that's dealt with on the chapters. But you'll see that it's not the first encounter that is mentioned in the verses of the chapter. Verse 17. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Sheva, which is the king's deal. Then we're told about Melchizedek coming. So we're told, you see, that the king of Sodom was coming out to meet him. We're told about the meeting with Melchizedek. Then we're told the details of the meeting, the encounter with the king of Sodom. Because, of course, the meeting with Melchizedek will absolutely determine Abraham's behavior before the king of Sodom and will show us some more lessons with regards to our life of faith. However, as I say for this evening, the encounter with the king of Sodom. Let's read our verses from verse 21. And the king of Sodom said unto Abraham, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Anar, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. Now, we're simply going to pick out some lessons with regards to the life of faith there in those verses. And what is probably the broad, overall, basic lesson with regards to our life of faith set forth there in that encounter with the king of Sodom is simply this, my friends. Mark it down in your heart and mind. Take headings, if you like, in your heart and mind, because there are those kind of lessons that we want to draw out this evening. The first lesson is this: with regards to the life of faith, after the victories come the temptations. Never forget it. Or you're going to move from victory into defeat in your Christian life at any given point in your Christian life in a very short time. After the victories come the temptations. And that's basically what is involved in that encounter with the king of Sodom and Sodom as he now rides forth to meet this man Abraham. And the king of Sodom said unto Abraham, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. He's making him an offer, don't you see? Here he is saying to Abraham, here is the bounty of the war. Take it all. Here's the prestige, here's the position, here's the power, here's the plenty. I'm heaping it all up for you. Take it all to yourself and let it be for yourself. Of course, he isn't going to give him everything, at least not yet. Not everything just yet. The persons I'll keep for myself, he says. But you take everything else except the persons, and he's offering them the power, the prestige, the plenty, and all those things that come with, all those things that he offers to him. It's quite an offer. Quite an offer. It's Abraham under the trial of faith, of course. We've seen him already in the negative, you remember, concerning the famine when he went away down into Egypt. We've seen him in the positive example when he stood with that man Lot, his nephew, and has refused to lay hold even of that which was his right with regards to the land of Canaan, and gives Lot the first choice. Choose whatever you want, he says, and I'll take whatever you don't choose. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. And now here again, be sure of this. It's the trial of faith that Abraham is confronted with in the confrontation now with this king of Sodom who comes out to meet him. For bear this in mind. Remember, we said in the introduction to the chapter last week that the real battle of Genesis chapter 14 is not the battle between Chedorlaomer and his associates and the five kings of the five city-states of the Jordan Valley, nor indeed is it necessarily the battle between Abraham and them, but now comes the real battle. The real battle. Now comes the trial of faith, my friends. Chedorlaomer and all his host coming up to put down that uprising of those five kings. That's not the real issue of the chapter, as we said. That kind of battle, any earthly kind of battle, and bear it in mind, my believing friend, those battles are incidental to the real battles which are fought out on the face of this earth, and that's the battles of faith which the children of God enter into with their old adversary, the devil, either for the honor or the dishonor of him who loved them and gave himself for them. The world views things completely differently, of course. And as we said, the only reason you get that king and his three associates and the other five kings of the city-states, the only reason you get them recorded on the history of God's word is because they stand related to the child of faith, Abraham, the pattern of the life of faith at this time. The world thinks differently. And my, the world's press and the world's books and the world's media, they would have covered this whole thing in a sensational way. You could have seen it blazoned out in headlines. Eastern Bloc coup d'etat, Kremlin uprises, sends in her forces, and the whole world would be taken up by it. My friends, How easy for us to be taken up by those things that concern firstly this world in such a way that they can be detrimental to our spiritual stability or our spiritual well-being. And never forget the real fight that is being fought out is the fight that is being fought out with regards to the glory of God in his people on this earth. And I tell you, be more careful about the attacks of Satan in your heart than any attack by one country against another in this earth. And be more wary about the ground that you're giving up to the old adversary than any inch of ground that is being lost by one worldly state to another. And it becomes us to stand and not look how the geography of this world is coming on, but how the geography of our own hearts is coming on, and where we have gained ground, and where the devil has made inroads in our fight of faith. That's the issue. We need ever to get our priorities right, and we need ever to see what the real issues of this life are all about. And they're all about, ultimately, they're all about our arriving in heaven at last by the grace of God with a good testimony, so that through that same grace of God, our Lord Jesus, he'll say it, well done, good and faithful servant. That's our concern, my friends. That's our concern and our prime concern. But you see, Abraham has won the day, as we say. He has engaged in the battle. But now comes the real battle. And as the king of Sodom comes to ply him now with all the offers of his esteem, how careful, dear old Abraham needs to be. For from the height of victory, you see, how easy it is for the devil to come, just like the king of Sodom here. He's a good enough image of him. And how easy it is for him to come. And how warily will Abraham need to tread, as we need to tread after those times when God has been gracious and has given a victory of one kind or another into our hearts, into our minds, into our lives. You know, one of that very sobering kind of words that Mr. Bunyan has again in the Pilgrim's Progress is when he tells us about the man that swaggered in the Pilgrim's Progress. You know who that was? That was one of the best pilgrims in all the Pilgrim's Progress. His name was Hopeful. So that when they come to the River Jordan at last, and dear old Christian himself is beginning to shake at the knees at the thought of the death that he has to pass through before he's going to reach that land on the other side, it's Hopeful that can bear him up. I says, Christian, thou wert always hopeful. Thou wert always hopeful. But my friends, it's Hopeful that enters into a conflict and gains the victory. And after he had gained the victory, John Bunyan writes those immortal words, and Hopeful began to swagger. Have you ever seen a Christian swaggering? And he's most likely, or she's most likely, to swagger when they've gained the victory. And once a Christian puts one's swagger into their spiritual step, my friend, I tell you, they're meat for the devil. Meat for the devil. And you see, now comes the battle. You remember dear old Peter. You remember that great confession that Peter made when all the rest of the world virtually was at sixes and sevens. Some thought that Christ was Jeremiah, some Elijah, some one of the prophets. And Peter stood up and he says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. What a victory. And the very next words that he's uttering, as though they came from the pit of hell itself, be it far from thee, Lord, thou art not going to Jerusalem to be crucified. Get thee behind me, Satan, says the Lord. And my friends, in the life of faith, be sure of it, after the victories come the temptations. Once by the grace of God we have been enabled to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, then go on standing still to watch for the temptations of the devil. For that's precisely when they come.
precisely when they come.
And let us get one inch above the ground in the estimations of ourselves or our spiritual capabilities. And I tell you, the devil is waiting to ply us with all his esteem, to offer us all his greatness and grandeur and power and plenty. And when Abraham makes his great reply here, he's putting words into our hearts and lips for our life of faith here below. And he's showing us how to meet those temptations that come after a victory has been gained. What will you see in the Shulamites, says Solomon, as the company of two armies, Chedorlaomer and his host, and the kings of the city-states? That war's over. Now comes the war. Now comes the battle. And it won't be fought in the plains of Siddim. It'll be fought in Abraham, the father of the faithful, as the company of two armies, the old nature and the new, the law of grace and the old law of the nature, and all these things come forth. And whose will be the victory? But be sure, right at that point of one victory comes the temptation. And unless we see that, it'll be a defeat instead of another victory that we'll experience. So then, this broad general lesson from that verse 21, after the victories come the temptations. Look at Abraham's response and at the lesson that comes forth out of it. Verse 22. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. What's the lesson? The lesson is this, my friend. It's the lesson of a past lesson, well learnt. How essential for your life of faith. It's not enough to learn a lesson, but very often you have to relearn the lesson. And you have that lesson that you first learnt, very often relearned, time and time again. And as Abraham comes here and makes his reply to the king of Sodom, there's this all bound up in his reply, that he's uttering something that he's learnt out of the experience of his heart. By God's grace, he will not make the same mistake again. You see, this is, well, what we would call post-Egypt ground. What do we mean? Well, you remember the great fall of Abraham, if we want to call it that, in chapter 12, in the second half. You remember when the famine was in the land of Canaan. And he went away down into the land of Egypt. And you remember how God took and did a dealing with him there. And then you remember how he came out of Egypt. And you remember how he began to retrace his steps. Out of Egypt, it says, and then to the south, and then to Bethel, and then to the place where his tent had been at the first, and then to the place where he had built the altar. And there he called upon the name of the Lord. And after Egypt, you see, came the post-Egypt days. And all the things that are bound up in Abraham's behavior there as he retraces his steps right back to that place where he had left off to be faithful in the things of his faith. And now you see, my friends, since that coming away out of Egypt, we've had all those positive examples with regards to the life of faith in Abraham. Mark that. There hasn't been so much as one slip in the life of Abraham from that time when he made his way back out of Egypt, back to the place where his tent had been at the first, back to the place where he had built the altar, where he called upon the name of the Lord. Why was that? Because, my friends, Abraham had learnt the lessons of Egypt, bitter and all as those lessons were. And you remember his behavior in Egypt. And you remember how he had entered into deceit. And you remember how Pharaoh then had begun to ply him with many things in that deceitful position. And he entreated Abraham well for Sarah. And he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses.
and camels. And Abraham had gained riches from a pagan king once before. My friends, here as he stands, he's standing not on Egypt ground, but he's standing on post-Egypt ground. He's standing on the ground that has learnt its lessons well. He's standing on the same ground as he stood not so long ago when he said to Lot, Lot, choose whatever you want. I'm through choosing. The Lord shall make my choice. The Lord shall choose mine inheritance from me. For me, he's standing on the same ground when he's just after looked around at his 318 trained servants and the host of Chedorlaomer Omer and the kings of the east and says, 'Tis enough if the Lord is with me. That's the ground that he's standing on now, my friends, when he turns to the king of Sodom and he says, not so much as a shoe latchet, not so much as a shoe latchet, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. My friends, at this juncture in his life, and I trust there are junctures in our lives like it, Abraham is only concerned with laying up riches in heaven, where neither moss nor rust can corrupt, nor thieves break through and steal. And where his treasure is, there his heart is also. And he's standing there learning what that same thing did to his life of faith not many months before. And standing now on more solid ground that has come through that mill and through that furnace and has learnt the lessons of the heat of it that was on his soul in those days. He'll take the legitimate, or rather let the legitimate be taken. The expenses and those around him, those that had accompanied him in the battle, verse 24, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Anar, Eshkel, and Mamre, let them take their portion, the expenses, if you like, the legitimate things. Yes, all right, that can be the case. But for himself, he stands here illustrative, don't you see, of the life of faith. And he has learnt before his cost what it is to be indebted to a pagan king. And that lesson has not been forgotten. Learn the lesson to learn from past lessons, because that will surely help us in our life of faith. We might just contrast Abraham's behavior here before this king of Sodom and before that king of Egypt, that Pharaoh, and learn this lesson as well with regards to the life of faith, my friends, the joy of a good conscience in this life of faith. Don't you remember Abraham there before Pharaoh? Don't you remember the deceit? Don't you remember the dubiety? Don't you remember the half-truths? Don't you remember when that pagan heathen king there turns and rebukes him? He's got nothing to say, nothing to say, for there is nothing that he can say. Look at the contrast here, my friends, as he stands up before this king, none daring to make him afraid. How much he had to swallow hard, how many lumps he must have had in his throat as he stood there before Pharaoh during those days. Terrible thing, my friends, to have a lump in your throat with regards to the things of your Christian life. And here he stands, we say, none daring to make him afraid. Note this well and mark it down well. He's not brazen. He's not brazen. Cheek isn't faith. Cheek isn't faith. A brazen neck isn't a good conscience, but a cauterized conscience very often. And dear old Abraham stands here something like old Alexander Gordon of Knockbreck, you remember, and that lovely statement when the king offered him the knighthood and he couldn't take it. No, your majesty, excuse and pardon me, but no. That's Abraham. That's a clear conscience in the life of faith. That's being able to stand, my friends, when they come plying you with those things, and because you know to your cost how much such things have cost you in your Christian life, being able to stand, drawing on the resources of those memories, well and hard learnt, and saying, no, no. Not cheekily, yet confidently. There's another lesson. The lesson of learning well the principle that having begun in the Spirit, we are not made perfect in the flesh. Now, you'll know that text from Paul, I'm sure. The actual setting, of course, of the words of Paul is with regards to the church at Galatia. There was coming into the church at Galatia more of these heretics that troubled the church in the apostolic days. And they were coming in, they were saying, look, there are certain things that you have to add to your Christian life. The fleshly rites, circumcision, and the things of the law. You can't really be a full-blown Christian unless you have all these things as well. All right, have your gospel, have Jesus, and have all the rest, but you must have all the accoutrements of the old law and all the rites of the old law as well. And it's to that situation that Paul writes and says, O foolish Galatians, having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect in the flesh? Having begun with a spiritual work in your soul, are you going on to perfect that work? Are you going to be circumcised then to make Christ greater to you? He says, I tell you this, if ye be circumcised, Christ profiteth you nothing. Nothing. Having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect in the flesh? That's the situation. Yet there's a principle that flows out of it, my friends. And having begun on the right spiritual course, you see, in our Christian life, it's the work of the devil to come very often, time and time again, and telling us, oh yes, well that was all right for an initial start, if you like. But now, you see, you have to adopt different policies. Now you're into a different situation. Well, we live in a different world today than people lived in long ago. And here's your family. Well, you have to adopt certain kinds of attitude towards your family. It's one thing to cast yourself upon the Lord at the beginning. But you don't go on like that. You bring in other methods, you bring in other modes of thought, you bring in other kinds of wisdoms to apply to your life, and you go on like that. That's the kind of situation, beginning in the Spirit, casting on God. You go on then to trust not in God, but to trust in other things. And it's that kind of tendency that Abraham here, in his behavior before the king of Sodom, teaches us to beat down and reject in our life. Look at the verse 22. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. What's he saying? He's saying, look, king of Sodom. He says, I have taken an oath with the Lord. That's what it means to lift up the hand. I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. What was the oath to do with? Verse 23, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. What does it mean? It means this. It means, my friends, that long before Abraham ever entered into that battle with Chedorlaomer, he lifted up his heart and his hand to the Lord, and he said, in fact, this, he said, Lord, grant me the victory, and the victory shall be thine. For when the victory comes, I will not take so much as a shoe latchet of honor from any who offer that honor to me. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet. He has said, Lord, give me the victory, and I will gain nothing out of the victory for mine own honor, or for mine own self, or for mine own esteem, not so much as a shoelace of honor or bounty from it. He had sworn an oath unto the Lord, Lord, give me the victory, and I will not take. And the Lord had given him the victory, and now he tells the king of Sodom, I shall not take. You see, having begun like that, he's not going to end up any differently, my friends. And if this God towards whom he lifted up his hand could rout four of the most powerful kings in the eastern part of the world with 318 servants, then Abraham needed no king of Sodom anyway to make him rich. Don't you see that? Don't you see the title that he gives to the Lord? And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. What could the king of Sodom give to one who had committed his life to the possessor of heaven and earth? And don't you see the contrast? Don't you see what Abraham has done there in verse 20 with regards to his encounter with Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God? And blessed be the Most High God, says Melchizedek, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And what happens? It says then that Abraham gave him tithes of all. He gave him a tenth of all of his possessions. Abraham turned round, my friends, and not only did he not want anything by way of bounty from the battle that he had fought, which God had given him, but out of his own riches he gave to God one-tenth of all that he possessed. And don't you see that? It's a strange principle indeed, my friends. But let a man or a woman first give to God his rightful due, and at that point, that man or woman is uncorruptible with regards to the things of this world. There was a man, though some did think him mad, the more he gave away, the more he had. And as Abraham has given to God what it is God's right to receive from him, God has given to Abraham the wherewithal to refuse those things that Sodom offers to him by way of temptation. And we'll see the reason why shortly. All those things that the world counts as rich or great or powerful or of great esteem, if we give God our portion, we'll view those things aright and have them or reject them or lose them or refuse them as the case might be. Now, how that needs to come in the gospel, of course. Surely the whole issue with our unconverted hearts when we're unconverted is this, that we must gain the world. And Jesus says, look, if you gain the world and lose your soul. And surely if Abraham here, my friends, had held back God's portion, and what's represented in that tent? It's Abraham's life, Abraham's devoted life to his God. It's Abraham's life of faith that's represented there in what he gives to God through Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High God. And if he had held back that from God, my friends, and taken up Sodom's offer, what would that have counted for him when the grave would have opened up its mouth deep and wide to receive him? First things first. In coming to Christ, in staying with Christ, all your professing life through, we are called to live by faith. That principle is ever before us. And having begun by faith, we go on by faith. Having begun in the Spirit, we're not made perfect in the flesh. Having begun, my friends, by casting ourselves in God, on God we continually and must continually cast ourselves as we would live from day to day. Now then, that leads us into what is possibly the greatest lesson of all in this particular incident in the life of Abraham. And it's this lesson: learning well what the Bible means by the wisdom of men and the foolishness of God. Now you'll know that isn't a misquotation, the foolishness of God. For it's what the Holy Spirit of God through the Apostle Paul speaks about when it speaks about the wisdom of men and reminds us that the foolishness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men. Think, my friends, think how God stoops, as it were, to have us to understand what he would have us to understand. So that he virtually stigmatizes himself, as you see, by allowing the word foolishness to be attached to him. The foolishness of God. How wise is such a God who can permit such a statement to be used in his own word regarding him. But it's to make the point, don't you see? And it's when we come to see and acknowledge the wisdom and the power of God, as that wisdom and power of God is unfolded throughout all the Word of God, in all the incidents of the Word of God, line upon line, precept upon precept, and we come to see how the reversings of men's wisdom are set forth through this foolishness of God, then we see, don't we, that even the foolishness of God, could there be such a thing? Well, that's much to be preferred above all the wisdom of men. So it is here. Let me remind you of a like situation, one that absolutely dovetails with the real situation that confronts this man Abraham here. A few hundred years on from this event, something's going to happen. The children of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, are going to be taken away down into bondage in the land of Egypt. They'll be there for something like 400 years, as you know, until there comes that day when God will lead them up again out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. He will hear their cry by reason of their taskmasters, we're told. And he'll come down in delivering grace to save them. Now, you see, he doesn't save them because of their cry by reason of their taskmasters. That element is in it, of course. And between those sovereign decrees of God and those human responsibilities of man, you're always to look and to see what God himself had said he would do even from the beginning and would accomplish in the way that he said he would do it. See, in the next chapter of the book, the Lord begins to speak to Abraham there in verse 13. And he said unto Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them. And they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. They're going into bondage in the land of Egypt, and they're coming out of bondage from the land of Egypt, and God's going to bring them into the land which God is now promising Abraham to give to them hundreds of years before the events take place, so that when the events take place, it's not because the Israelites suddenly cry on to the Lord to save them, but because God has decreed to do it. Not only the leading in, but the taking out again into this land, this inheritance that God has promised to give to Abraham and to his descendants after. How will God work that deliverance? Well, he'll work it, my friends, in a most amazing way. And in a way that absolutely undercuts the wisdom of man that we're speaking about, the principle that we're to have in our hearts and our minds. For one thing, he'll begin to work that deliverance not when Israel's potential armed strength is at its height, but when it's at its depth. For one thing, they're slaves, and hardly a weapon of liberation between them. But not only that, that man Pharaoh one day looks around at these Hebrews in his land and he says, there are too many of them, and I'm going to get rid of them. And he issues that most inhuman and that most cruel decree that all the male children born to the Hebrews must be cast into the river Nile, so that, don't you see, there is no hope of any future army virtually for Israel to lead them out of the land of Egypt, for Pharaoh is beginning to destroy that potential army in the bud. In the bud. When you read in the 11th chapter of Hebrews and all the examples of the life of faith, remember it's this kind of situation that's bound up in that wee word that's tucked away there. When it speaks about all the vivid things that you can see about the beatings and about the mockings and about the scourgings and about them being sawn asunder, and then says Paul, they were tempted. They were tempted. And my friends, as those Egyptian stormtroopers began to rage through the Hebrew quarters in the land of Egypt, hauling out those crying male children away from their mother's breast and casting them into the river and putting them under with their spear, be sure of this, they were tempted. They were tempted. And there was one wee boy born. And his mother and father didn't want him to be taken and cast in the Nile. And his name was Moses. And they made a basket, you remember, of bulrushes, and pitched it, and took it down and set it in the flags by the river, intending to come day by day to feed him and to care for him, until miracle upon miracles he was found by none other than the daughter of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And she took him on to her own home. And he was reared up. And he was adopted. And he was called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He would have sat on the throne of Egypt. Now we see how God will deliver them out of Egypt. In all his mysterious ways, he has preserved out of all that infant male population one deliverer. He has taken him. He has caused him to be found by the daughter of Pharaoh. He is bound for the throne of Egypt. That's how it will be done. He'll become king of Egypt. And as king of Egypt, he'll be king of Canaan, because Canaan was tributary to Egypt in that day. That's how God will do it. That's not how God will do it. And my friends, there'll come that time when by his actions Moses will have to flee to the backside of the desert of Midian. And in the second 40 years of his life, there he'll stay until God will bring him back. And God, did God not raise him up to the position to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter? Yes, he did. For what purpose? To liberate Israel? No, my friends. For he wasn't going to liberate Israel by the son of Pharaoh's daughter, but by the shepherd of Midian, that no flesh should glory in his presence, and that the foolishness, absolute foolishness of God may be seen to be wiser than men. You remember the outline of the 120 years of Moses' life? 40 years in the courts of Pharaoh learning to be something. 40 years in the backside of the desert learning to be nothing. And 40 years leading Israel out of the land of bondage, learning what God can do with nothing. That's it, my friends. And what do you have here? You have exactly, you have precisely the same lesson in this particular part of Abraham's life, now standing unmovable before the offers of that king of Sodom so long ago. Don't you see what's bound up in the offer that that king makes to Abraham? In a word, my friends, he's giving Abraham the opportunity to put his toe in the door of the place of power in the land of Canaan. That's what he's doing. He's looking for him to be ally with the rest of them. He's giving him the opportunity, my friends, to become one with them. Take up your part of the spoils of war, he's saying. And after that, the opportunities are unlimited, surely. And one victory after another for this soldier that has suddenly appeared once and can go on doing his soldiering, surely. One victory after another until what? Until he would reign supreme. Could he not do it? My friends, could he not do it? This man who with 318 of an odd job lot of an army routed the four most powerful kings in the east, which all the united kings of Canaan couldn't do, would he not soon have reigned and ruled supreme? And their God would have given the land as he promised to give. Not a shoelace. Not a shoelace. For my friends, Abraham knows that when that land is finally given, it will be given in the way that God decrees and ordains. And he stands by faith. It's the promise that's under attack, my friends. The promise. And if God has said to Abraham, I'll give you the land, on the acceptance of that promise hangs Abraham's life of faith. And he stands there, don't you see, before the possessor of heaven and earth. Not a shoe latchet, he says. Not so much as a shoelace. Lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. How many lessons, how many principles of conduct, how many urgings to our own hearts and our own lives, be they as individual lives, be they as the churches of Jesus Christ. How many lessons, my friends. How much fleshliness is in our hearts and in our minds and in our behavior at times. How often we forget the principle, having begun in the spirit, we go on in the flesh. How many lessons we forget. How many victories we win only to plummet into defeat afterwards because we lose out on remembering the principles that God sets before us and looking to the ways of men and the things that attract us as surely bringing us those desired things that we would have and forgetting that God's apparent foolish ways, why these are mightier than all the wise ways of men. Another episode, another incident, another event in the life of Abraham. Other lessons with regards to the life of faith. Why do you think he stood as he stood that day? Why do you think he lived as he lived? Why do you think after he came out of Ur of the Chaldees for another 100 years he never set foot in a house but lived in a tent, counting himself a stranger in that land? Never so much as getting one foot of an inheritance in it. Why? Because he was going to the inheritance above. But while he walked in Canaan, he walked often through the fire. He walked for our learning, for our admonition, my friends, going no further than Abraham himself. Don't despise what he did that we might be taught in the things of our God, but going higher than Abraham. Be thankful that God ever set out his word for us in the way that he did. Not only by precept, but by embodying that word in those men and women who lived before. You remember, as Mr. Calvin said, who went to heaven with just a little shaft of light. And now the full blaze of the gospel day has come upon us. Shall we not live to please God? By faith. By faith.